welcome to the second of a monthly Bad Idea podcast. We are your hosts, Simon Abrams, and...
I'm Steve Carlson, and this week was a very, very, very bad idea.
It was a rather bad idea, but thankfully I can blame Steve for having it. Kind of, sort of, a little bit. The topic that we're going to be discussing is, what exactly do we talk about when we mean the worst video game movies? Because the video game film is not exactly, how can I put this, one of the more reputable
movies. It's not an inspiring genre.
Yeah, it's a little rough.
The highs are passable at best.
Right.
There's no Citizen Kane of video game movies. I mean, even the best video game movies I find are the ones that kind of take, that aren't actually based on video games.
Right.
That take the moves of video games, like something like Scott Pilgrim.
Okay.
Where it takes the language of that and finds a way to translate it into cinema. Without having to be hidebound to an actual video game that they have to be faithful to satisfy some imaginary, you know, market audience.
The flip side to that argument, of course, is that if you stray too far from the material, you get something like the Super Mario Brothers movie, which, personally, I adore, but I will admit freely, that is a guilty pleasure movie. I feel dirty and ashamed to admit that I love that film like I do, in ways that I do.
I loved it when it came out, and I saw it a bunch of times, and then I saw it a couple years later, and I was like, this is like the Super Mario game tried to fuck a steampunk novel and failed.
I don't know if you can fail to fuck a steampunk novel, my friend. They gave up very little resistance. I don't know if you can try.
William Gibson will not be denied.
Dear God.
Anyway.
So, yes, when we came up with this podcast idea, we didn't really have a set idea in mind other than the fact that I was looking up on the internet because I somehow got around to the topic of discussing the Super Mario Brothers movie, and I found out that there is a porn parody. I was thinking, why isn't there a porn parody called Super Hornio Brothers? And there is, in fact, a film called Super Hornio Brothers. I even thought of that title. I guess that's how unimaginative it is. And
there's a reason you haven't heard of it.
Yes. We just watched it. It is a film from, what year is it, 93?
I think 93, yeah.
And it stars, of course, Ron Jeremy as the Mario role, although he's called Squeegee or Hornio.
And that is the absolute end of the inspiration right there.
Right. So, yes, let's talk about that movie, though, since it's fresh in our minds.
Can we not?
Buck Adams.
I haven't drunk enough to reasonably talk about this piece of shit.
If I drink more...
Neither has my wife drunk enough.
Yes. In case you haven't noticed by now, we're recording in a new location. Mr. Carlson's been kind enough to provide us with a place to record because we noticed, as some of you have told us, that the sound levels last week, or last... The last episode, really, because it wasn't really on a set time schedule, were a bit off.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to record in a bit more quiet an environment for your listening pleasure. In any case, Super Hornier Brothers. Let's talk about it.
So, boy!
Yes. Buck Adams, one of the stars of the film, he plays King Cooper,
yes,
of all people.
Instead of King Koopa.
Yes.
Ho, ho, ho!
Very clever, yes. He apparently had a vision for this film and was originally planning on, I think we read on IMDb that it was a 37-page script for what he planned on being a 3-day shoot. And the idea, the whole thing was considered so ridiculous that someone, this is what kills me, there was a set visit from a porn magazine on this that reported that the sets were lavish, the plot was hard to follow, and that it was in general a bit of a bust.
Yes.
So, apparently, the people that originally financed the film, who was this?
Sin City, one of the big video porn companies in the 90s.
Yes, they originally had, like this, member of the press that visited the set, they had very little confidence in Adams' project, and they had to have, what was it?
Midnight Video was the company who came in and rescued it, but they took the script, demanded extra sex scenes, and allowed Adams to make it the way he wanted, on the condition that he cut the budget in half and make two films out of it. So you can imagine how well that worked out. Super Hornio Brothers is... It's a porn film that doesn't work as a porno because it's got that very early 90s aesthetic where everything is just, you know, slow and...
slow motion. The egregious abuse of slow motion is on Zack Snyder. It's on Zack Snyder levels, my friend.
And it's, you know, everything's supposed to be quote-unquote erotic, but it's just syrupy and heroin-addled.
It's mostly because there's, like... a lot of real problems with the person, whoever's handling the camera, just doesn't know where to put it, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the antithesis of what you're looking at. It's very direct. They know where to stick the you know...
the camera.
Slot A goes into slot B, that's how it goes. But the camera is usually...
should I focus on the mechanics at play, or should I look at the faces? Or?
Yeah, there's a lot of reaction shots of ugly-looking men doing O-faces in slow motion. There's very awkward shots of just above the ass of women. There's some very straight... there's a lot of standard shots that they repeat.
The gynecological money insert shots, as it were.
Yes, during the lesbian love scene between the Spider Woman and Princess.
No, it's not the Princess. It's some random chick who...
Yes.
I don't know who the hell she was, but I think it was the Bondage Queen, actually.
So, okay, yes, it was the Bondage Queen.
And that right there speaks to the film because there's a character in the film called the Bondage Queen, and she doesn't tie anybody up. She doesn't whip anybody. She just wears leather, and that's why she's the Bondage Queen. Because she's in leather, and that makes her different.
No, but let's scale back a moment. What probably confused the person that was visiting the set of this film, they probably have a less idea about the concept of how interactive video games are.
Mm.
Basically, it's the same cliched idea of TV shows like VR Troopers and Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad. If you were a child of the 90s, you'll probably recognize these names. If not, you'll probably just be giggling and wondering what the fuck I'm talking about. Yes, like that.
Yes!
And the point is, all these shows share in common the idea that how do people interact with video games? Well, they get sucked into a computer, and they start thinking that they are the characters that they're playing as. That's what Super Hornio Brothers does, and it essentially, the two Hornio brothers, Ornio Hornio, and, of course, Squeegee Hornio, they get sucked into this computer, and...
They've created the world inside the computer.
But not completely, as we're told. Squeegee Hornio apparently, through a very long-winded and rather strange exposition, tells us that the computer is partially responsible for creating the game. So that's why you have Buck Adams as King Pooper sounding like a lamb chop puppet, who also...
You haven't quite defeated me, Hornio! He's like Lamb Chop crossed with Mr. Hanky.
Yeah.
Crossed with a dude who's just had his nuts yanked off, and he's old, and he's got bleach blonde hair, and he's terrible.
Yeah, but the bleach blonde hair speaks to something that I find interesting. This is basically a movie that is it's not even concerned with the video game at all at this point, naturally, because it's a porn parody. Mm. But this, as I mentioned before on Twitter, is basically a porn parody of a film that's only initially vaguely related to the film that it's supposedly based on. The Super Mario Brothers movie with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo and Dennis Hopper, whose hair is the model for Buck Adams' character's hair.
His weird, modified quad mohawk.
Yeah, that is totally just showing you that the people that made this film, Buck Adams specifically, obviously didn't play Super Mario Brothers, which, admittedly, the people that made the Super Mario Brothers movie didn't either, but the fact is that...
they at least managed to know enough about the film to throw in little nudges and references, like they at least, you know, they knew what a Koopa was.
Yes, they were Bob-ombs.
Granted, there were Bob-ombs. I mean, and yeah, the Koopa was not the Koopa as the game players know it. It was a giant reptilian thing with a tiny head. But the point is they named something in the film Koopa.
Yes.
Not Koopa, Goomba. I'm sorry, I'm fucking up here.
By now...
The point is they knew enough to make references to the game, even if the references weren't spot on.
Right. What we should enunciate here is we're not trying to say that this movie is terrible because it isn't true to the video game. It's just especially that much more surreal because of it. You're watching the film and you're wondering, what the hell were they thinking here? Like, at least in porn parodies today, at least for the trailers that you see for the Human Centipede porn parody and Star Trek.
They're eerily dead on.
Yes. Like, they are by people that are big fans. They are by people that have watched and know the inside jokes. They're literally giving fans fan service. You know, they...
The Batman parody. The example I find most most indicative of that current trend is the Batman parody.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Horner, who works without a mustache, deliberately grew a mustache so he could paint it over in white like Cesar Romero did while playing the Joker in the Batman TV series.
Wow.
That's how dedicated they were to getting it right.
And
this is a film that gets nothing right. It doesn't care. It's like, you're watching us to wank. We know. We're just slapping a name on something because there's a brand there. And we know we can profit from it.
But at least in that one...
It's mercenary in the worst kind of way.
No, but at least in that one, you're basically telling me that there was, at some point, at least a couple of details that show you that the people involved in the making of the film were actually interested in parodying what they're looking at.
Yes.
This is like a, as you were saying, a pure mercenary work. It's just, the idea is that Super Mario Brothers was hot at the time, so why not make a porn parody of it? And it's especially odd because, or it's especially hard to watch because it's both a loveless film and a totally incompetent one. Like, I have to say, you probably have to have a sliding scale to rate porn and,
even on a sliding scale, this thing is abysmal.
It's very hard to watch. It's very boring, which is probably one of the worst things to be when you're watching a porn. You don't want to be bored.
No.
And it's what, part of the things that I've noticed in the films that we watched today. I more than anything else, preparing for this podcast, I was really rather bored while watching a lot of these films.
Some of them, yeah. I mean, I was watching different films than you were, and we're going to cover some of those in a subsequent podcast we decided needs to happen about video game films that are so bonkers that they're actually pretty good.
Yes, those are the movies. Those are basically the highest you can aspire to when you're looking for a good video game adaptation. You want to find movies like the Super Mario Brothers film or
Street Fighter.
Street Fighter, the Jean-Claude Van Damme version, is actually surprisingly good. If you haven't seen it, you may laugh, but
it's a film you have to walk into understanding that nobody involved in the production was taking it seriously.
Right. Absolutely. There's that great Godzilla fight scene with,
yes.
Is it Raul Julia and
No. It's the characters of Zangief and E. Honda.
Right. No. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Now I remember that. Yeah.
And it's got Raul Julia as Bison hamming it up and talking about making the food court in Bisonville bigger. But this is all stuff we'll save for that particular podcast. Here we're talking about shit and failure.
Yes. Super Mario Brothers is decidedly a shitty and fail-tastic film, basically.
It is the nadir of video game films, which should make Uwe Boll feel a lot better.
Yes.
His place in the cinematic firmament.
Yeah, his films were also a topic that we felt we needed to broach on the subject because, well, he's made a lot of really just shitty video game adaptations, hasn't he?
He still has House of the Dead to answer for.
Yes.
Which is the one video game film that is so bad that it actually resorts to including footage from the video game.
At multiple times.
Yes. It isn't something that, like, he just hit on an inspiration and went, oh, we should throw this in as a little goose to the audience. It's like, no, I don't know how to shoot action sequences. So, whatever. We'll just throw in footage from the video game and no one will notice. But yeah, it's pretty obvious that we do.
Right. Which brings us to the film that we're going to be largely talking about when we characterize Boll's approach to the video game adaptation and why he's just in general... Oh, well, actually, we'll be talking about two films.
Yeah, well, it's because I think there's a certain evolution in how Boll has made not just his video game films, but his films in general.
Right.
Related to his public reception, in that he's... I don't necessarily think he started playing to a certain audience of cultdom, because I don't think he actually has a cult. I just think he's at some point he kind of realized that he doesn't need to be making films for any audience.
Right.
He's going to make the films that he wants to make. And slowly but surely, if you follow his career, which I have because I'm stupid, his films get daffier.
Okay.
Like, you know, like House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark, which is one of the films we're going to cover. They're silly, but they're terrible and they're boring. That's their great sin. They're boring.
Like, if you watch, immediately when you start watching Alone in the Dark, you're sort of oppressed by this ridiculous ream of scrolling text that gives us this giant diuretic dump of information and a lot of just, there's so much exposition. Like, at one point, Steve commented while we were rewatching the film, you know, thank you, Captain Exposition. I'm like, well, that implies that there's a singular person giving out exposition in this film. Everyone in this film. Every other freaking line is exposition. Christian Slater, for instance, who is the... You know you're in trouble when Christian Slater is your male lead. He is monologuing like a son of a bitch exposition at us via voiceover. And he does it through multiple scenes. But, again, it's just like this huge series of just... dumps, really. Like, and just giant...
And that's the thing. They're setting up this entire world. Like, this epic, just... tangled, incoherent setup world for what essentially in the second half of the film devolves into monsters attack.
Exactly.
It takes 45 minutes for them to set up monsters attack.
And it's at that point you could argue that basically Bull is trying to take a lot more seriously something that really just doesn't need to be taken seriously at all. Like, the fact is that, like it or hate it, which you... kind of crazy to like it.
Yeah, pretty
much. The aesthetic of the film actually is, like, this very conscious attempt to, like, be very grim and look like the film is, like...
He's aping what the Hollywood trends at the time were, because at the time he was still trying to make a financially acceptable film.
Right.
Like, you know, you look at House of the Dead, you look at Alone in the Dark, you look at Blood Rain... These are films that were deliberately crafted to fit into certain slots, to work within the Hollywood system.
Right.
He had his eyes on the prize here. Like, you know, he saw an opening, and he went for it.
Right, but he's so incompetent that basically all of the techniques that he's actually trying to carry out, in theory, even if they were sound at that point, just don't work. Like, for instance, we were talking about like his execution and overuse of aerial shots for helicopter shots. Now, normally, I would say that most people would use 3 to 4 second long aerial helicopter shots. Bull uses like 8 to 10 second ones, and it feels excruciating because it feels like he is looking for something. Like, it's no longer just an interlude between scenes. It's like, did I drop my contact lens? Look, there's a building down there. It could be there.
It's something that it's a shot he knows he can't fuck up.
Yeah,
basically.
And he relies on it like a crutch.
Yeah.
But back to the cinematography, like the cinematography, it speaks to like someone that's clearly trying to like get you to take him seriously as like someone that is giving really just hammy and ridiculous material gravitas. Like, it looks like it's shot from the bottom of a beer bottle. It is terrible. Like, it is murky. It's
shadows and poor light sources and the fucking just awful.
Fake grain. There's a lot of fake grain.
There's a lot of fake grain. And people, actors who shouldn't try and ever look serious, looking serious.
Oh, yeah. This movie has Tara Reid as a scientist in it.
Yeah, there you go. That summed it up.
The film basically is... it's just one long, exhausting trip to, as Steve said, like, very inevitable conclusion. And, like, the whole time, you don't get the sense that anyone involved... like, if they were to crack a joke, like, it would just be, A, purely perfunctory, and, B, done so joylessly that... It would never come across as a knowing joke.
And there's a couple unintentional laughs in Alone in the Dark. My favorite being the line where Christian Slater yells at the big bad, "Don't be insane!" It's just the combination of words It's, you know, and Slater's really committed delivery.
Right.
That just, it doesn't work, but it doesn't work in a way that is hilarious.
By the way, we should mention that Stephen Dorff is also in this film, and we were joking.
No, we shouldn't.
No, we should, because we're joking that, like, people who are wondering where Stephen Dorff came from or what backlot
he'll be going back to after Somewhere.
Yes, where Sofia Coppola basically found him passed out to star in Somewhere. And I think she probably was just one night she might have been at Netflix and someone, as a prank, put Alone in the Dark at the top of the queue. And she took it out and she said, you know what? This guy I want in my movie about an actor on the skids. Yeah.
But and the thing is, you know, like we were saying, yeah, you can see that Bol is trying to fit his films into a template.
Mm.
He's trying to do something with that, and he clearly can't.
Mm.
And the thing he's trying to do that he can't is bring it gravity.
Right.
And as his career evolved, segueing into the next film we're going to talk about, I think he kind of gave up on the idea of playing that game.
Absolutely.
Of running with the big boys, of trying to make a serious film. And he just decided it's okay to let his retarded muse loose.
That's fair. I mean, as you said, the next film we're going to talk about is Far Cry, a 2008 film. That's 6 years later? 7 years?
Yeah. Actually, only 4 years later.
Really?
It didn't get released until 2009, and even then it was a home video release, but...
Did you like the way I said, really, like, I really cared, by the way?
No, not at all.
Really? But yeah, there's a great gag, or a great failed gag, I should qualify, at the beginning of Far Cry, this 2008 film, where he basically...
The main character.
Till Schweiger.
Till Schweiger,
a very German, uber-German... actor. At that point, Bol is trying to emphasize the fact that he's very pro-German and anti-American. So he has this scene where Till Schweiger, the all-American German, basically, but in name Aryan, who is taking out a couple of, like, according to Bol, stereotypical Americans, this couple that they have gone whale watching, and after 3 hours...
In the middle of what looks like the Pacific Northwest in an inlet where...
Yeah, it's like a pond. It's a big pond.
Yeah, I think the unspoken joke is they're ugly Americans to the point where they don't realize they can't whale watch out here.
Yes.
There won't be any whales.
Yes, and that's why...
They're in fresh water, for Christ's sake.
That's why Bol has one of the actors, the woman, milk this line for all it's worth, where she whines, George, what about the whales?
And then George complains about the whales not being there, and Schweiger goes, you want to drive? You can drive. I'm going to have a beer. Do you want one?
Yeah, the thing with the steering wheel of this is there's, like, a bicycle chain around it. So, like, apparently they're pedaling.
Yes.
But, you know, the point is, the gag is basically that Schweiger tells them, like, well, why... I never promised you whales. I never promised you that you would get what the tour could potentially give you. And that's basically Bol's way of telling his audience, fuck off. If you're expecting something, if you're expecting to be entertained and you aren't entertained, it's not my fault. It's your fault for basically not being receptive enough to my charms, my considerable charms. Yeah.
Bol, if you've ever listened to one of his commentaries, Bol is insane.
He is.
And part of that insanity is his enormous ego. And there's a certain level in which I find that charming. In his later works, because he's given up on the idea of making a film that would be acceptable to mass audiences. He's just throwing in shit that he thinks that, according to formulas, should work.
Right.
And it's going to work because he's Uwe Boll, damn it!
Right, and because it's...
And that's why you get, in the middle of In the Name of the King, you get ninjas popping up in a Middle-earth fight. And that's why, you know, Far Cry is it's a stereotypical 80s action movie, but you have Till Schweiger walking through it with his bemused look that said, I just drank a fifth of Jack Daniels before I came on set. I'm fucked up and I don't care. And you have Udo Kier walking around, you know, listening to Wagner on vinyl because he's evil.
Right.
And telling an underling with great seriousness right before he kills him. I have to finish this painting.
Yes, yes.
Basically, I think the value of Far Cry as opposed to Alone in the Dark is that Uwe Boll inadvertently has gotten a couple collaborators who are in on the joke.
Really?
You know, it understand that there's a joke there that Uwe himself doesn't actually see.
I think it's interesting. I don't know if I buy that. For me, I think Boll's sensibility has always been so loudish that I think that even if you would argue that the screenwriters or the actors even are in on the joke, that there isn't a marked difference between, in tone at least, between Alone in the Dark and Far Cry. Like, for instance, his idea of screwball comedy is having an elderly couple tell the husband, "I'm going to get my gun," and his response is naturally menopause.
But at the same time, he understands that that Boll has learned enough to understand that you need kind of the odious comic relief character,
right?
And he finds one and doesn't introduce him until halfway through the film.
Yes,
when that, you should be done introducing characters.
That's a Coppola, isn't it? Carmine Coppola.
I have no idea. I know he's the dude who keeps complaining about his sandwich being.
No. I mean the actor. But anyway.
No, I mean I don't know who the actor is.
But yeah, the thing is, what is funny because like you could watch this film and initially you might wonder, does Boll just hate women? I mean, there's certainly a case to be made for that. Like when what's her name, the female lead, she cooks him fish and as a gag,
she burns it.
She burns them and he says, Hilschweiger complains they're crispy. No, she defends her action by saying they're crispy and
they're burned.
Yeah, exactly.
But he eats them anyway.
Yes, and that's the thing. Like
or the seduction scene, which again is in there because it's obligatory.
Yes.
But it's just, it's like the least seduction scene. It's like, "Oh, I am cold. I have been in the water. I have hypothermia. I need to take some of my clothes off.
You're shot.
We should warm up. Body heat. It's just a scratch." And then all of a sudden, "Oh, right. The script says we need to kiss, doesn't it?
You better get out of those wet clothes." No. He said that. I remember. He delivered that line like he was Willem fucking Dafoe. "You better get out of those wet clothes." Spider-Man.
That's what I find.
Oh, wait. No. The best part about this scene of seduction, though, is the harp music. You gotta remember.
Oh, yeah.
He says, until Schweiger, while the harp music is playing, I have to take off my pants, you know. Turn around.
Yes.
Which is, no, but that specific part shows you.
It's the turnaround that makes it.
Yes, the turnaround part, though, is like a definite attempt on Boll's part to basically, again, he's much more defensive now. He's trying to show you that he's not sexist. He is just doing, like, a really bad job of doing, like, gender role reversal. Like, when, there's that line, "You better be here when I get back," that she initially says, and he mocks her for saying, and then later...
"You better be here when I get back." Yeah, and she reverses it on him, yes.
Yes. So basically, it's his way at this point of saying, "I don't hate women, I hate everyone.
Everyone.
I have no respect for... I don't have no respect for a certain percentage of my audience. I have no respect for any part of my audience."
And I know it sounds... contrary, but I do find a certain value in that.
Okay.
I'd spoken to you about Rampage.
Yes.
Which we haven't seen yet. We'll cover in the subsequent cast, but it definitely, it's kind of the me plus ultra, as it were, of that particular cynical outlook on Boll's part. When he lets his hate flag fly, he really does.
No, absolutely.
But I find Far Cry kind of fits in with something like Deadly Prey or The Stabilizer. Where it's a film that's consciously made on a micro budget to emulate certain action tropes. And it does it, but it does it slightly off at every turn, so it feels vaguely alien. Like it's another culture trying to translate what we see as action.
Yes. No, absolutely. It condescends to its own material.
I find a certain inspiration in that. And I don't even necessarily see it as intentional all the way. I just find Boll that blinkered, I guess, that he thinks that he's passing these cliches with all sincerity, and And at the same time, in his later films at least, there's a certain self-awareness. He's like, yes, I am the German, using the German cliches of the American films.
Yes.
Where he's trying to be sincere and postmodern at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. I like the fact that, like, his Germanness is definitely a thing in Far Cry. Like, the fact that a character with, like, a stereotypical American name, like Jack Carver, is played by someone named Til Schweiger.
who cannot shed his German accent.
He doesn't try. That's the thing.
Yeah, and he's not even trying. He doesn't care. He's like, yes, I am German. What of it?
And the fact that, like, there are at least two or three chase scenes in Volkswagens. You'll note the fact that, like, every time a car is about to get rear-ended, you'll see the Volkswagen symbol.
Yeah.
We Germans, we certainly know how to make a car that's good at being rear-ended. God. I think we should end this segment by using the quote where it says, you owe me a meatball sandwich.
You owe me a meatball sandwich.
I guess I do, Steve Carlson.
I don't know what else there is to say about horrible video game films, but...
They're basically just know there.
That,
yeah.
Just know that Uwe Boll, for all of you, you people out there who might crack on the fella, there's worse out there.
Yes,
there is far, far worse.
He is at least an auteur amongst shit.
Yes. he may be an Ed Wood or a Ray Dennis Steckler level auteur, but he at least has a sensibility. And
maybe a Ted V. Mickles level auteur.
If whatever, at least that's more we can say about Buck fucking Adams.
Oh god, Buck Adams.
Or if I may get a dig in here, Simon fucking West.
Simon West. Yes, I reviewed the Mechanic remake. Thank you.
No. I'm just saying. I'm just bringing up because I hate Tomb Raider with every fiber of my being.
I don't remember it enough to actually care.
Yeah, and that's about what it deserves.
Right. But yeah, so this week we're gonna transition right into our monthly segment of the Netflix grab bag, where we have you, the listener, choose what we watch. We take a couple of titles at random out of both Steve and my our respective Netflix queues, our instant queues, and our hard actual like queues for discs, and we have you vote on which one you want us to look at. And last time, our four choices were the documentary Rivers and Tides, which got no votes.
No votes.
I don't even know what it's about. What's that about?
It's about Andy Goldsworthy, I believe his name is. He's an artist who works in natural mediums.
Yeah, like, no one
literally,
likes this guy.
Literally carves like trees and shit and something like that.
Nobody likes this guy apparently because no one voted.
I've heard it's pretty good, but it's kind of past its cultural point, I guess.
Right, yeah. Past its point of relevance. I agree.
Which is more than we can say for the other film that received zero votes.
The Vicious Kind. Yes, that was a contemporary film. I hadn't even heard of this. What is this?
Directed by Lee Tolan Cryer. Stars Adam Scott and. Oh, Brittany Snow. It's about a fella who goes back home. I think it's supposed to be a Tennessee Williams type thing. I've heard it's actually very good,
right?
For what it is, it was one of those things I stuck on my queue. It came on the instant queue in like last March or something like that, and it's just been sitting there. And I've been going looking at it, going, I should watch that sometime, and never quite did. Which is kind of the point of this feature, you know, to drag out those films that you look at and go, I should watch that, and then never do.
Yes,
but no one cared about that film either.
Yes, the two films that were most heatedly voted on were Gus Van Sant's first feature, Malanoche, which that's all I know about it. And
I know it's his first feature. That's about it. And Criterion apparently liked it.
Yeah, this is very true. And I think that was released around the same time as they released the first film as
My Own Private Idaho.
I was going to say Solo con tu pareja, which is the first Cuarón film, isn't it? Alfonso Cuarón?
Yes.
And that also did not win. The film that got the most votes was Jess Franco's Venus in Furs.
Because you all hate us, apparently.
Yes, I have to say, I was actually looking forward to this film. This was a film that we actually both had in our queues.
Yeah.
But...
I might suggest that we may have encouraged someone to vote for it. Expressed that was kind of the film that we wanted to see, because this is the Bad Idea podcast, after all.
Yes.
And...
Good films don't belong here, honestly. It's not a good fit. But Venus in Furs is most definitely not a good film, so good job.
It's not... the problem is it's not even bad in interesting ways.
Right.
It's bad in a way I despise, personally.
It's a very sluggish movie. It's a film that, like, feels like it's getting at material that is already dated and generic to the point of...
There's a very heavy concentration on the music in the film. The film centers around a jazz musician.
He plays his horn.
Yes, at the time, I tried hard to remember why I buried my horn. Because, you know, there's no Freudian intention in that whatsoever.
No, yeah, that's...
Nothing at all.
It's so frustrating to watch this.
I just wanted to sum it up for people who haven't seen it. It's about a jazz musician, a trumpet player, who finds a dead body of a woman washed up on the beach. And later runs into her after he moves from... Is it Istanbul to Berlin or something?
Yeah,
I think that's correct.
Yes,
doing this whole thing with I thought she was dead.
He shacks up with this new woman though. He shacks up with a nightclub singer.
No, it was in Brazil. That's where he went.
Right,
because she's Brazilian.
Because she's black. Yes,
yes.
Because I think Jess Franco just wanted to work with an interracial couple, and he chose Barbara McNair, who plays the singer at the club. Her name is Rita.
Yes.
And unfortunately, Barbara McNair is totally bland, even when singing the title song.
She's so dull. It's just...
Venus and Furs. Oh my fucking god!
Venus and Furs is the kind of movie where they keep flashing back to the corpse on the beach, and then you'll get heavy, portentous voiceover. There's the voiceover all over this film. It just slathered like fucking mayonnaise. And, she was dead, but was she alive?
Steve, can I interrupt you a moment? I think that's a very unfortunate image, but keep going.
It's okay.
Who uses mustard that abusively?
Mayonnaise.
Whatever. That's disgusting. Keep going.
Anyway, she was dead, but was she alive? Was I dead, or was I alive? And the minute you hear that voiceover, you know exactly where the fucking movie's going.
I love the voiceover bit where he says, she was dead in Istanbul. How could she walk through the door like that? It was crazy. it was the crazy part that kills me.
But that's kind of my major problem with the film. It's not that it's boring. It's that it's boring and it's headed somewhere extremely obvious.
Time is like the ocean. You can't hold on to it.
Yes.
Why?
I don't generally engender spoilers in reviews, but I am totally going to spoil the fuck out of this movie.
Cover your ears, children.
I don't care. It's terrible. You shouldn't watch it. It turns out that
Why would you say that? But keep going.
I would say it's not worth watching in the slightest.
I'd say there's that really good scene where some gross-looking tubby guy is, like, clearly having, like, a orgasm/heart attack on a bed while the mysterious white woman in the film that is pursuing
the Ray Milan looking motherfucker.
Yes, that's pursuing this fat guy that looks like Ray Milan is having like a giant coronary on this bed during like a very odd proto-Lynchian dream sequence where this woman is just the most erotic thing and the most explicit thing she's doing in the scene is reaching her right hand and, like, not even totally fondling her left breast under this fur coat, which is the only thing she's wearing, but she's just sort of, like, threatening to touch herself, basically. And this guy is, like, dying the closer her hand gets to, like, actually doing something erotic or...
It's funny you mention that scene, because that's actually the scene where I decided I hated the film.
Really? I think that movie is actually, like... that scene is to me, the highlight of the film. Like, it's the only scene that actually actively had my attention. And that's saying something, considering that this film has Klaus Kinski in it as a bored, rich guy that tortures... in an early scene, you see he tortures the woman that washes up on the beach.
And that's the one scene that had my attention. Not just because of the fact that it was the scene with the most exploitable content. Because of the way it was filmed.
Okay.
It looked like the one scene where Franco actually gave a crap. Because, you know, you have that one spotlight wheeling around madly, just catching glimpses of what's going on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the protagonist is at the window, staring through the window outside, and he can't believe what he's seeing, but he's only catching snatches of it. As we in the audience are, it's a whole riff on spectatorship, and combined within the sadomasochistic play that's going on there, and I think there's something really interesting going on there. There's a certain perverse energy in that scene that the rest of the film just doesn't have at all.
I think that movie though, like the thing is, I think Franco is what a lot of people who defend Dario Argento would like to imagine Argento is. He's a very intellectual filmmaker whose exploitative work just seems, or if Venus in Furs is an indication, because admittedly, I shamefully have not seen any Franco films other than this, but send recommendations in the comment section. But the thing is, he's obviously someone that's toying with these pseudo-intellectual ideas of sexuality, of dominance, of physicality, of the meaning of sadomasochism. And there's like this one scene where that I actually kind of liked, but it gets kind of exhausting to constantly see someone who uses these kinds of scenes so haphazardly, where this woman is like tracing her finger along this like marble statue, and she gets to like the pubic area, or at least where a groin should be on any normal male, and there's nothing there. It's just sort of like a lump, and that's exactly what he's drawing your attention to, the eunuch nature of the statue. And it's actually kind of interesting, but like the fact is, when those little like moments between scenes in a plot, which, as you said, you can kind of tell what's going to happen by the end, those little moments are actually the only exceptional scenes in the film. The scene you were alluding to with Kinski, where the camera is wheeling about and you're seeing all these bored rich people torturing this girl for kicks, it's really just too labored for me. It's like trying to basically get across a point that Gialli, like by even lesser directors, get across very simply, the whole voyeur victim.
I see where you're going with that
relationship.
You also have to keep in mind if you're gonna go there that this film was made in, I think, 1968, I believe.
Right.
So it's essentially pre-Gialli.
No, of course. No, what I'm saying is,
if anything, you could see it as kind of a precursor of where that genre ended up going.
But I don't buy the idea that if something was there first, it's essentially better. I think that,
I'm not arguing that either. Yeah. I'm just arguing that's the only part of the film that really caught my attention.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, because I think for my money, a movie that much more seamlessly works in its pseudo-intellectual slant on voyeurism is the American film Who Killed Teddy Bear?
Which I haven't seen yet, but I know I need to.
It's a terrific film. Yeah. When was that made? Was it made in the 50s?
I want to say 62.
65.
Oh, bah!
You were both wrong. It's got Sal Mineo in it. It's really just an exceptional film. And Elaine Stritch, Jesus. it's this really bizarre movie that basically takes us, like, it reveals to us very prematurely in the film the character who, Sal Mineo, who is the serial killer, basically, and it gets us to sympathize with him. Like, he has to take care of this, like, I guess she's kind of emotionally disturbed or emotionally, or like some kind of proto-autistic level of Asperger's, or she just can't get along. He has to take care of his sister. And it's, there are like all these little flourishes where you get the sense that he's actually, the director, Joseph Cates, is engaging with and like probing like the weird relationship that he has with this girl that he wants to ask out with, but he can't bring himself to. Hmm. And like there's this great, almost Godardian moment where like there's a display of books in a bookstore, and they're all about the fact that they're different subjects. There's like one on sociopathy, there's one about like voyeurism, there's one about like symbols, and it's like a total like Roland Barthes style like riff on the fact that look at all this. Like, you wouldn't think of these topics, but since they're in the same space, you're forced to reckon with the fact that maybe they are related. And
right.
that to me is something that Venus in Furs just is too interested in self. It's too lazy to
interested in surfaces at the expense of everything else.
Yes.
And which gets back to, let me get back to the point I was about to make.
Go ahead, sorry.
In that the film is essentially dicking around until it gets to its ending. And one of the reasons I very much dislike this movie is because it adheres to a certain structure I find abhorrent. Which if you've ever seen the movie Carnival of Souls,
Herk Hervey film,
yes, it has that very famous twist in the end where it turns out the heroine was dead all the time, and Venus in Furs does that. And the thing I dislike about this structure so intensely is that if done wrong, which most of the time it is, it acts like it's concealing a secret. And that's all it has. Like, if you treat the big reveal at the end as your secret, then that's really all you have going for you. And right. you basically have to waste time until you get to that. The few movies that actually get it right, like, say, The Sixth Sense, make their A plot about something else entirely. Mm. And, you know, then reveal in retrospect that it was about the big reveal about, you know, the character being dead the whole time. But it finds something else to busy itself with.
I would argue that that's not necessarily a fair correlation between it and Carnival of Souls, because that film, which was made in 1962, by the way, is actually, I think, the listlessness of it, just like how some people have complained that the first half of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the sequel version, is a little too listless for its own good. Like, it takes too much time setting up things. Like,
well, those people are bonkers. But.
Yes, I agree. But the listlessness of Hervey's film up until that big reveal, as you say, at the end of the film, is pretty essential. Because the movie, to my mind, is so much about survivor's guilt that, like, it needs to have that aimlessness. It needs to have that perverse sense of directionlessness that I think makes it so effectively moody. And I think this movie is much more unconsciously aimless, if you want to put it that way.
And I understand what you're getting at, and I guess I agree intellectually in regards to the Hervey film. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of actual filmic space, the film doesn't really give me anything to latch onto.
Okay.
It is just aimlessness. I understand it's purposeful aimlessness, but after a while, I need you to give me something, anything, other than, oh, this chick is wandering around. She's probably dead. Because if you give me that intellectual space to that space to think around what you're showing me, I'm going to figure out your big secret.
Right. And I think that's part of a lot why we didn't respond to Venus and Furs. I think the kink in it is the main appeal, and even that is a little too tame to seem that remarkable.
There's just not enough of it.
Yeah.
There's too many scenes devoted to, you know, the protagonist playing his horn while his, you know, whatever her name, Rita? You know,
yes.
While she,
Rita,
you know, sings. Yeah. Or, you know, scenes with him reuniting with the girl he thinks is dead and having sex with her. And it's just very flaccid and dull, and there's nothing to latch onto, so, you know, you start thinking about what's really going on here. How could he be seeing this dead chick? Oh, right, he's probably dead.
Right.
You know, and
spoiler!
Oh, noes! If you're going to construct something like that, you can't give the audience the space to think about it. You have to offer them something else.
It's true. It's a very monotonous movie, even when it's, like, in a, what I would argue is a more extraordinary scene, like the one that I described with the fat guy on the bed having a heart attack, because those seem to almost intrude on Franco's narrative. I mean, obviously, in the hands of a better director, that would be an intentional choice. But in Franco's hands, it just seems very besides the point.
Yeah.
It seems like it's just there, and for the large part, it's just intruding on, like, a rather mysterious nudie cutie. Like, the fact that there's, like, a Jesus, because that's his alternate name. Jess Franco. Anyway, there's this really monotonous and droning soundtrack of that sounds like a little ringing bell throughout the film. And every time that intrudes, you're supposed to be cued to the fact that, like, the synthesizer in Halloween, like, something's going to happen. Or at least that's what the protagonists are anticipating, that something's going to happen.
And
here it's just sort of like every other moment that little jangling bell sound is going, and you're just like...
And I had quipped at the time, I wish I'd been watching the film that the score's composer had been watching. Because it was clearly a more exciting film.
Yes.
Like, in the scene that you had mentioned with the fat guy, it starts out with not him in the bedroom lying down. It starts with him in, like, his drawing room or something, seeing this, you know, seeing the dead woman in mirrors and things, and, you know, looking around and seeing her, and then not seeing her, which is an editing cheat anyway.
Mm.
As he stands up to get up, the score crescendos, and then nothing happens.
Right.
Then he walks into the bedroom. It's just like it was intended to be something else there, and there's nothing.
Right.
Which could just describe the movie as a whole.
Really. I think we should probably end on that note and just let you know that the way that the... Remind you again that the way that the Netflix grab bag feature works is that we have you, the listener, ostensibly, pick what films that... pick from a couple of films that we have randomly selected from either our queues. This week, we're taking it from my regular Netflix queue. And so do be sure that once you're finished listening to this to vote on your choice for next month's podcast, where the subject will be why Herschel Gordon Lewis apparently matters. There's a documentary.
He does.
Okay, that's great. Don't believe him, folks. There's going to be a mini retrospective of Lewis's work at... not even a mini retrospective. It's just like three films. The guy was so prolific. I mean, anyway, the point is Lewis's stuff is going to be showing at the Anthology Film Archives in March to accompany a documentary about him, and that's going to be the main topic of next month's podcast.
Commissioned by Something Weird and Mike Vraney, so I expect it to be kind of a hagiography, but whatever.
Right, but. The Netflix grab bag choices that we're going to give you are hopefully a lot more interesting. We have one choice is Goyokin, a 1969 film directed by Hideo Gosha, the guy who directed, Sword of the Beast, Onimasa, I think there's a film called The Wolves, it stars Tatsuya Nakadai, and who else is in it? There's someone else in it. Oh, dear. I can't think of it. Anyway, it's not coming. Let's move on. there's another... Your second choice is Darling Lily from 1970, the Blake Edwards film that inspired... Starring Julie Andrews, that inspired Edwards basically to make...
S.O.B.
And I say inspired very loosely because it just drove him up the wall enough to make S.O.B. because S.O.B. is such a bitter movie. But Darling Lily, which I'd never seen, and I'm a big Edwards fan, so that could be interesting. The third choice is The Silent Partner, a 1978 caper film with Elliot Gould and Christopher Plummer and Suzanne York. Jeez.
Suzanne, and she just died, too.
Suzanne, oh, she did. I didn't know that. Yeah. John Candy is in this movie. John Candy.
John Candy is in there fulfilling the Canadian requirement.
Yes, he is. yeah, wow.
Because The Silent Partner was shot in Canada, for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, now you do.
Thanks. But yeah, there's that. And our final choice is the Jonathan Demme-directed adaptation of Spalding Gray's Swimming to Cambodia, which is a one-man show, as a lot of Spalding Gray's things are. And it's about, as far as I know...
His time in the movie The Killing Fields, right?
Yes, making that film and about his experiences in general in Cambodia. So, as the title implies. In any case, what?
Nothing.
In any case, we hope you enjoyed this week's or this month's episode. Can you tell I'm still a little buzzed?
Anyway, and we're going to drink more!
Yes, so that's why Steve's giving me the motion to wrap it up. So
I'm thirsty.
We're thirsty, apparently. So do us a favor. Leave some comments in the comment section and let us know what we're doing wrong, what we're doing right, what you'd like to see more of.
Or hit us up on our Twitter feeds, because I'm sure anyone who's listening to this follows us on Twitter.
Yes. So thanks, and we'll hear from you again soon, or vice versa, I'm sure.